And give us understanding as we seek to study your word. In his name we pray. Amen.
So what we're doing here is telling a story about a man who hasn't been part of history yet, but certainly will be a part of history someday. And so we're going to talk about the end of his career. So this week we're in 2 Thessalonians. We're doing an overview of the man of sin, and we're going to talk about that man of sin today. We call him the beast. We call him that because the book of Revelation calls him that. And we're going to talk about his destruction. So this is the beast destroyed. Now let's go back and kind of look at the end of the story today. This week we're going to be covering what I call the phase four of this four-phase career of this man of lawlessness. So we began in 2 Thessalonians, and we've now expanded out to many other books of the Bible. But we're going to find out today that this beast is going to be the first resident of the lake of fire, and I call this triumphant to tormented. And so where we are this week, we've looked at his career from the rapture of the church to his signing of a covenant with Israel, his support by the Christian church, the false church in the tribulation period, where he's killed, he goes to the abyss, he's raised. He with the false prophet is described in Revelation 13. He, the Antichrist, along with the false prophet, will take over the world, or that will be their attempt to take over the world. So we're going to look at his career today. When he is raised, he's going to rule until he comes to a time called Armageddon, and we're all familiar with that word. We've all seen the movies. He's going to come then to phase four of his career, and he will end up in the lake of fire. So that's a summary of his life, of his phases in the tribulation period. So this dictator of all the nations of the earth, who is satanically empowered and is able to pull off this miraculous delusion, he's raised from death. He kills two witnesses who have been provided by God to witness the truth in Jerusalem, while the Jews have completely turned from God to make a covenant with this leader who becomes a dictator. He proclaims himself as God in the temple. His false prophet makes an image of him and puts it in the temple, and that begins the beginning of the religious service in the second half of the tribulation. All men must worship this image or they'll be killed. All who worship receive a mark in order to buy or sell. Now that's economic control. So he's going to take over religiously and economically. He's going to get rid of the false church. He's going to get rid of the nation of Israel because he's going to take it over, put to death anyone who opposes him. Have Paul making a summary of all this in 2 Thessalonians 2:8. 2 Thessalonians 2:8 said that lawless one will be revealed by his resurrection, proclaiming himself as God in the temple, whose coming is in accord with the working of Satan, with all power, signs, and false wonders, with all the deception of wickedness to those who perish, to deceive those who reject God, but who really want to believe in this person, because they did not receive the love of the truth. And where were they hearing the truth? They're hearing the truth from the two witnesses who God puts in the midst of Jerusalem. We saw this last week, Revelation 11. They do not receive the love of the truth so as to be saved, so as to be rescued by God, though by receiving the truth they will not be rescued from this man of sin because he will behead them because they won't worship him. If you follow God, you're going to lose your head. But if you follow him, you're going to end up with destruction. So verse 11 makes an interesting statement that for this reason God will send upon them a working delusion so that they will believe what is false. They will believe the lies of this man who proclaims himself to be God. They will receive the mark. They will be deluded by the image and by this resurrection. Words false, the word pseudo, used twice in this passage, once in verse 9 and once in verse 11. Pseudo, the word false or lie, is what looks real but is not real. It's the essence of deception, what looks real but is not real. That's deception. Notice the word working. The word working is used twice as well, the working of Satan and the working delusion. Those two go together because the working is a word for energy. It's a word, Greek word for energy. It's energized activity. And the beast is energized by Satan. In fact, Satan enters the beast, just like Satan entered Judas Iscariot so he could go betray Jesus. And this man is the ultimate betrayer. The image of the beast is energized by Satan. Because it's the image of the beast that is really the heart of the delusion that men do believe that this must be God. The word delusion there, working delusion, the word delusion is the Greek word for planet. Well, when the Greeks looked up at the sky at night and saw the stars, they noticed they were fixed in the sky, but planets seemed to wander. So the word for planet meant something that wandered off course. And in this case, it means to cause what is false to seem like what is true. See how that ties with the word pseudo? So the word delusion and pseudo read to go together, to cause what is false to seem like what is true. That's what God is allowing when he allows this man to proclaim himself as God, to make an image of the beast. He's allowing what is a lie to seem like what is true to those who want to be deceived. To make a lie appear true. Another way the Greeks use this expression was to cover the eyes with lies. So there's so many lies, you begin to question what's really true. So God is giving people what they want. They really don't want to believe the two witnesses. They don't want to believe the word of God. This sounds better. This looks better. This man has promised to rescue them, and they believe him. And so the delusion is his the middle of the week, his proclaiming himself as God, taking over, this image coming to be. It's not the removal of the church that's the delusion. If you tell somebody the gospel today, and we get raptured, say, next week, they may think, maybe that person who's disappeared was right. They can then believe the gospel after the rapture. But here's the point, point number six. All who worship receive a mark in order to buy or sell. Once a person worships this image, they receive a mark that allows them to buy or sell. There is no going back. They buy into the delusion that does not ever allow them to change their minds. They're locked in. They're marked. That makes sense? Okay. In phase three, all the events of the last 3.5 years, that's from the time he's killed to the time he's raised, from point number three, all the events in the last 3.5 years move toward one thing. They move toward Armageddon. Now, Israel and the false church are completely done away with. Israel's leaders are cast aside because who's ruling now? The Antichrist, the beast. The false church is done away with. Remember we read in Revelation 17, they burn the harlot, this religious system. They do away with it. There's a new worship system. He is now the worship system because he says, I'm God. So you worship me. Satan has always wanted the world to worship him. Satan has his man, indwells him, and he's gaining the worship of the world. Or that's what he desires. So everything to this point leads him to Armageddon. Now Armageddon is pretty clear evidence that he has not gained the following of the entire world. And Armageddon is right near the end of the 7 years. You just skip right to that, to this time of Armageddon. So what is Armageddon? It's the end of the 3.5 years that he is in control of the nation of Israel and the economic system of the Western world. Now let's look at Revelation 16. You can turn there if you want, but I've summarized it down. The path to Armageddon has a divine cause. God is allowing this. Revelation is talking about God pouring out judgments on the world during the tribulation. It says the sixth angel poured out his bowl on the Euphrates River over by Baghdad today. And east of that is the Far East. India, China. The angel poured out his bowl on the Euphrates River and it dried up so that the way would be prepared for the rulers from the east. Now this prepares the way to Armageddon, the path to Armageddon. And out of the mouth of the dragon and out of the mouth of the beast and out of the mouth of the false prophet came three unclean spirits. And John says these unclean spirits are like frogs. He's not saying they are frogs. He says they're like frogs. And what do? They're spirits of demons. So that defines them. Going out to the rulers of the whole world to gather them together for the war of the great day of God, the Almighty. So who's allowing this and causing this is God sending forth his angel to pour out a bowl on the Euphrates River to allow this to happen. But the actors in that are the dragon, the beast, the false prophet, and the demons they let loose to gather the people together to come to the great day of God, the Almighty. That's talking about Armageddon. And look what it says in verse 16, makes it very clear. And the demons gathered them together to the place called Har-Magaddon. That's Hebrew for the mountain of Megiddo. And Armageddon is the Greek that means the mountain of Megiddo. Now there's a political cause for Armageddon. That's in Daniel 11. It talks about the king in the book of Daniel that is the beast who is to come. It's the same king he's described in Daniel chapter 7. But here he's going to define him politically and some of the political machinations that are occurring. Then the king will do as he pleases. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god and will speak monstrous things against the God of gods. Isn't that what we read in 2 Thessalonians? Same wording. Paul is really writing about things that already have been written about. He's just trying to explain them to the church. He will show no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the desire of women. He will show no regard for any god. He will magnify himself above them all. Here's a man who puts himself above everything. That's why he's called the man of lawlessness. Rules and laws are for suckers. He will honor a god of fortresses. That means he honors military might. He honors military strength. And how does he make the covenant with Israel to allow Israel to build a temple? Because he says, I have the military might to back up what I want. And he's magnanimous enough and charismatic enough that people go along with him. So he's able to broker a peace treaty in Israel that allows him to build a temple. It'd be a phenomenal feat. Well, he goes on to say that he will gain control of Egypt and Libyans and Ethiopians. That's that band along the northern coast of Africa, Egypt over to the west. And that's called the Kingdom of the South in the book of Daniel. But rumors from the east, that's beyond the Euphrates, and the north, that's the kingdom of Rosh, as described in Ezekiel chapter 38, that's Russia and the nations of the north, they're not buying into this guy being the leader of the world. The rumors from the east and the north will disturb him, and he will go forth with great wrath, and he will pitch the tents of his royal pavilion between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain. He's talking about the seas that they would be familiar with, the Mediterranean Sea and the Caspian Sea. He will place his pavilion there. The holy mountain is Zion. Yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him. It's saying here that this king, who is the beast of Revelation 13, will die on that plain between Zion and the Mediterranean Sea at Armageddon. The beast meets the armies near Jerusalem in order to protect his power and his worldwide rule. And what's the problem is he wants worldwide rule, but really doesn't have it yet. So he's going to fight this battle to gain this power. It's there that he meets his end. And so this is talking about the Battle of Armageddon. Now at the Battle of Armageddon, there's two great suppers. Now let's look at what Paul says in 2 Thessalonians 2:8. He says, that lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring him to an end. So who's in control of all these armies coming together to this Valley of Armageddon? Paul says it's really God behind it all. But he's allowing people to make their choices and to carry out what he's always intended to happen in history. He's going to bring it about through the hands of wicked men. Now, he's going to call for a supper. There's two suppers mentioned in this chapter. Revelation 19:9, blessed are those who were invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb. Who's the Lamb?
Jesus.
Who's his bride? Us, the church. He's coming back with his church. So not only is Jesus being revealed to the world, but his bride is being revealed to the world. And notice it says there are people who are going to be invited to that marriage supper. These are people who gave their lives during the tribulation. These are people who died in the Old Testament before Jesus ever went to the cross and was raised from the dead and began the church. They're going to be invited to this marriage supper. We talked about this before. It's a little silly to say that the bride is going to be invited to the marriage supper. That's assumed. Now there's another supper in verse 17. This one's more gruesome. I saw an angel and he cried out to all the birds, come, assemble, come for the great supper of God. To eat the flesh of kings and commanders and mighty men and horses and the flesh of all men, free men and slaves, small and great. It's a supper for the birds. The men who are gathering together to impose the Antichrist. But when the heavens open and they say Jesus Christ, the whole focus changes for them. He's now the enemy. Jesus does have the ability to unite the world in unity against him. So those are the two great suppers. One for the birds, one for the friends of the bride. So Armageddon is the final battle of this age. And Armageddon is not the end of the world. It's the beginning of a new world. It's the end of the old world. Revelation 19:11, this is Armageddon. I saw heaven opened and a white horse, and he who sat on it, called faithful and true, in righteousness he judges and wages war. This is our Lamb, Jesus, waging war. This is the Lamb become a lion. And the armies which are in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, were following him on white horses. That's us. From his mouth comes a sharp sword. That's 2 Thessalonians 2:8. Remember, he will slay them with the breath of his mouth, that so that he may strike down the nations. This is all these national armies gathered together to fight against the Antichrist are now going to fight against the real Christ. But he's going to strike them down, and he will rule them with a rod of iron. Where does it say that in the Old Testament? Psalm 2. And then 19:19 says this, I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies assembled to make war against him. See how they gather now together against him? Against Jesus? Came here for a different reason, but now we're against him who sat on his horse and against his army, against his bride. So let's look at the battlefield. The battlefield's fascinating. You can see there circled in yellow, Megiddo. That's the mountain of Megiddo. Har Magiddon in Hebrew. Armageddon in Greek. And notice to the north, Nazareth. Isn't that amazing? Jesus was raised from the time he was a little boy up until the time he left to go down into the valley of Jordan River to be baptized by John the Baptist, worked and lived overlooking Jezreel Valley, which is going to be the historical battle of Armageddon. He grew up on the north side of this valley, this Jezreel Valley, which goes from the port of Haifa today down to Beth Chain, which is in the Jordan Valley, right of your screen. It's interesting because Revelation 14:20 says an interesting thing. Revelation 14:20 says, blood came out from the winepress up to the horses' bridles for a distance of 200 miles. So the blood from this battle is going to run down a distance, down to a place called Bozrah, which is about 193 miles from Haifa. And the blood, it says, the blood from these battles are going to cover this valley. 200 miles. At some points, up to the horse's bridle deep. This is a massive slaughter. You can see why God's called the birds of the heaven to gather together to eat this up. It's got a lot to get rid of. But that's an interesting passage. Revelation 14:20. Kind of right in the middle of the book, talking about this coming battle. It doesn't get described really until Revelation 19. So the dictator of all the nations of the earth, by a miraculous delusion, is able to rule for 3.5 years, and that's it. That's it. That's all he gets. Up till the point of Armageddon, Jesus comes. Once Jesus comes, this first resident of the lake of fire goes from triumphant to tormented, and that's phase four of his career when he ends up in the lake of fire. Now it's interesting, when you go to Revelation 19, it tells you something about what happens to the beast. The beast was seized, and with him, his right-hand man, the false prophet, who performed the signs. He deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who would worship his image. See how clear that's stated? The deception that took place? And these two were thrown alive into the lake of fire, still living into the lake of fire. And that means they're destroyed. Everything they have is gone. That doesn't mean they're annihilated, however. They're there in torment forever. They're there alone because there's nobody else in the lake of fire. Jesus said that the eternal fire, and he's talking about the lake of fire here in Matthew 25, which has been prepared for the devil and his angels, was never intended to be prepared for man because Satan and his angels fell before man was created. And so God said, you're going to end up in this place of destruction, never intending man to be there. But what happened? Satan came to the garden and talked to Eve, lied to her, and made her question, well, maybe what I believe isn't true. What she had been clearly told not to eat of that tree. He told us that. Well, she had the truth, but he made her question it. And so when man fell, now man is destined for this place, unless someone intervenes and saves men. Not only were the beast and the false prophet seized and thrown into the lake of fire, but I saw an angel. This is in 20 verse 1, yeah, in Revelation. I saw an angel coming down from heaven holding the key of the abyss and a great chain in his hand, and he laid hold of the dragon, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. He threw him into the abyss, shut it, and sealed it so that he would not deceive the nations any longer. So that means what? He's deceiving the nations now, right? He will not deceive the nations any longer until 1,000 years were completed. Then, after 1,000 years are done, he's going to be released for a short time. He's there for 1,000 years. He's going to be released after 1,000 years. How long is 1,000 years? There's only two choices, aren't there? It's not a matter of opinion. It's a matter of interpretation. You have two choices. You've already said it. It's 1,000 years, or it's something else. It's a long time, some indeterminate number, but it's not 1,000 years. So those are your only two choices. It's either 1,000 years or it's not. So the demons are out and around the world, and Satan is free to roam in the world and do what he wants to do. But in this time, for 1,000 years, he's going to be bound, and all of his demons are going to be bound in this place called the abyss. Okay, so now the kingdom begins. It talked about the 1,000-year reign of Christ. There is going to be a 1,000-year reign of Christ. And the real 1,000-year reign of Messiah will begin once Jesus does return with his bride. And what he's going to do, he's going to establish the throne of David in Israel, that he's the one who's an heir to the throne of David. So there are going to be Jews who are going to go through the tribulation period, who are going to believe the words of the two witnesses and of the 144,000 that are anointed during this 7-year tribulation period. But 2/3 of the Jews will be killed. 2/3 of the nation will die. That is in the book of Zechariah. And so only 1/3 of the Jews end up being part of this population of the kingdom. What about Gentiles? They're going to be divided into two groups. They're called sheep and goats. What happens to the sheep is they go into the kingdom under the authority of the nation Israel. Now, sheep are people from other nations. The Jews would call them the goyim, the nations. Enter citizens of the kingdom. 25:31 is where it starts. When the Son of Man, Jesus, comes in his glory and all the angels with him, he will sit on his glorious throne, the throne of David. All the nations, anyone who is not a Jew. This distinction is being made here. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them like the shepherd separates the sheep. Sheep are docile. Now, this is meant to be a picture. Jesus said while he was on earth, I am a shepherd. I am the great shepherd. I'm going to be like a shepherd, not like a despot. But he's going to separate the docile animals from the goats, and goats are considered by shepherds to be unruly. So they would not put them together in the same pen. So he's going to separate them out. Now, this makes perfect sense to someone in this culture. And he will put the sheep, that's some of the Gentiles, on his right, and the goats, that's other Gentiles, on his left, and then the king, and the king now goes from the Son of Man, who is Jesus, down to the king, who is Jesus, will say to the Gentiles on his right, come, you who are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. These are survivors of the tribulation and physical bodies going into the kingdom under the nation of Israel. The nation of Israel has already been judged and established. Now he's bringing in the nations, the people of the nations, to serve with him. In verse 25:41, he says this, he will say to those Gentiles on his left, depart from me, accursed ones, into the eternal fire which has been prepared for the devil and his angels. Now it makes it sound like they're going to the lake of fire immediately, but that doesn't happen immediately. Why doesn't he say you're going to go into the holding place until the 1,000 years are completed? Why didn't he say that? John wouldn't come for another 60 years to write that. And Jesus is not presenting anything that has not yet been revealed. Jesus doesn't talk about the rapture of the church. Jesus doesn't talk about the 1,000-year millennial kingdom. He never says, I'm going to come and reign for 1,000 years. Never says that. He doesn't say anything that's not already revealed. So this passage is talking about a judgment that's going to take place to determine which Gentile people are going to go into the millennial kingdom and which are going to be consigned to a place called Hades, which Revelation 20 talks about, till they're then judged and put into the lake of fire. Last thing, this book. I urge you to get this book. He presents us in a pastoral way that's easy to understand, easy to follow. And he says something in here about sheep-goat judgment that I could not pass up. He says, if the rapture and the glorious appearance happened simultaneously, there would be no need to have a judgment of the sheep and the goats. I thought, well, I'm going to comment on this, but I went, you know, I read this and I went, nobody can say this better than he does. He says this, he starts this little section, who's in and who's out? Who will qualify to enter into this kingdom? All those who pass the test at the judgment of the nations discussed by Jesus in Matthew 25. To quote the words of Jesus, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels of heaven with him, he will sit on his throne in heavenly glory and all the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people from one another, as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. We should note in passing that this text is further proof of the pre-tribulation rapture of the church. If the rapture and the glorious appearing happened simultaneously, there would be no need to have a judgment of the sheep and the goats. That separation would have already occurred when all believers were caught up into the clouds to meet Jesus. The only plausible explanation is that there is a period of time between the rapture and the glorious return when people do come to trust in Jesus as Messiah. When is that time period? It's the tribulation. Thus, this judgment does not take place at the rapture, but it takes place after the tribulation, just before the millennium. The imagery of sheep and goats would have been familiar to the first century listeners. Sheep and goats, I'm told, don't get along well. Sheep are usually quite docile, whereas goats are very unruly. So in this context, the sheep enter the kingdom and the goats are cast out. Jesus explains the terms of the judgment. Then the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. I needed clothes and you clothed me. I was sick and you looked after me. And I was in prison and you came and visited me. And remember, Pete, they said, well, when did we do this? And he said, whenever you did this to the least of my brothers. And I can imagine him pointing his hand to the Jewish people who have come through the tribulation who are now part of his kingdom. Because they're not nations. They're Jewish. Has Jesus changed the terms of salvation? Is he now teaching that we are saved by our deeds of kindness to the poor and those who are imprisoned? After all, he commands those who fed the hungry and visited the oppressed in prison and invites these to enter the kingdom. Whereas those who neglected these good works go to everlasting destruction. Then he will say to those on his left, depart from me, you who are cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. There is a better explanation for these verses than to say that deeds of kindness save us. Remember that during the tribulation period, the faithful do not take the mark of the beast. These people will endure persecution. They will be jailed and many killed. The Jews especially will be targeted for persecution and martyrdom. The righteous Gentiles will want to support their fellow brethren, the Jews, and will do whatever is needed to stand in solidarity with the Jewish people. These Gentiles will have proved their loyalty to Christ by the way they treated his brothers. Verse 40. My brethren. Their sacrificial kindness is not the root of their faith, but the fruit of their faith. The bottom line is that only believers will enter into the kingdom about to be established. Both Jews and Gentiles who refused the mark of the beast will be found worthy to enter the kingdom and to hear the words of welcome from Jesus. As for the others, they will go away to eternal punishment, but the righteous to eternal life. So I think it's very good in the way he sets that out. Three paragraphs from an excellent little book. So I really encourage you to get that. Next week we're going to talk about the chosen and called. The security of God's elect. The absolute security of God's people. So with that we'll pray. Dear Father, we do thank you for this time we've had. We live in a time.